Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. This is Dan Turchin, host of AI and the Future of Work, advisor at Insight Finder, the system of intelligence for IT operations, and CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. Now, we've met some amazing authors and inventors on this podcast. Back in season one, we met Mark Settle, who wrote the book on being a high-tech CIO in Silicon Valley. We met Charlene Lee, who wrote the definitive manual on being a disruptor at work. We've learned about autonomous driving from Dr. Evangelos Simoutis, who wrote the book on the future of transportation and the social implications of AI from one of the pioneers of venture capital, Bill Davidow. If you haven't listened to that episode, go back, open the vault, listen to Bill talk about the social implications of AI. If you're a regular listener, you know, we dissect AI and the future of work from every angle with the visionaries who are really defining it. Well, today is no different. In fact, today's guest wrote the book on AI and the future of work called The Organization of Tomorrow as part of his PhD thesis. I encourage you to go get it from Amazon and read it. You'll enjoy it. Dr. Mark is not only a three-time best-selling author, but he's also a renowned global keynote speaker on topics related to AI, data analytics, and blockchain. He's also an accomplished entrepreneur, having started Dataflock and more recently Maven to address the problem of eroding trust in global media. You'll want to hear more from Dr. Mark after today's episode. I encourage you to watch his, we'll call him dispatches on YouTube as a digital speaker in which his avatar provides insights about new advances in AI. Check out his latest musings. He talks about GPT-3, the future of journalism, and zero-shot learning, which is quite interesting. If you're not already, follow him on Twitter, at Van Rijmenam. That's at V-A-N. I will spell it for those who are Dutch impaired like myself, at V-A-N-R-I-J-M-E-N-A-M. Great tweets to follow. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Mark to the podcast. Mark, such a pleasure to have you. Let's get started by having you share a little bit about your background and how you got into this space.
Well, thanks for having me, Dan. It's great to be on your show. And I think I'm really looking forward to discussing everything related to AI. There's so much happening in this space. So my background, you already mentioned it. I have been founding two companies. One is called Dataflock, which is a content platform around emerging technologies. And the other one is Maven, where we are developing a trusted source for content, which are recommended by peers instead of algorithms to fight misinformation and sort of restore trust online. I'm also part of a Two Tokens Foundation here in the Netherlands, where we try to develop a roadmap around tokenization. And I've been in the speaking world for about almost a decade now, where I help organizations understand these technologies. I call myself a future tech strategist. Not only talking about what these technologies are, but more importantly, how they change the organization and how you can benefit from it in a way that is beneficial to the company, also to the customers and to society in general. So yeah, very much happy to be here. And as you mentioned, I have recently digitized myself. Since I talk about digital, I thought that knowing also the Corona crisis, I was impacted and I couldn't fly anymore. So I decided to digitize myself. I thought it was a great metaphor. If I can become digital myself, any company can become digital. It comes with great benefits because now I can talk at multiple locations at the same time. All of a sudden, I can speak Mandarin, Arabic, Hindi, French, Spanish, whatever, you name it. And it's just a lot of fun to record shows in virtual reality. On top of that, it's a lot easier to pronounce than my last name. So the digital speaker is a bit easier.
Good. Well, I certainly didn't struggle with the digital speaker like I struggled with your real last name. Now, you and I both share a lot of the same research interests. We both speak to a lot of CXOs on similar topics, AI and the future of work. I want to get your perspective. As you travel around virtually or in the past physically and present to execs, what are some of the topics they're most interested in hearing about from you? And where would you say are their biggest blind spots?
So I think the biggest, the most interesting topics that that my audience wants to hear about is like these emerging technologies. At first, it was big data. That's where I started with in my career, really talking about big data and how you can use data within your organization to empower your employees and empower your customers. And more recently, obviously, AI and especially blockchain also came into place because these technologies are going to have such a fundamental impact on how we run organizations and how we build our society, that they are also quite difficult to understand for a lot of CXO leaders, because at on the surface they look really easy to understand, but if you dive deeper, then all of a sudden there comes a lot of more things to think about when you talk about blockchain or artificial intelligence. So that's somewhat. That these are the most common areas that I talk about and that I help organizations understand, what do these technologies mean? How can you use them? How can you use them for good? Because any technology is neutral and you can use it for good or you can use it for bad. How do we deal with the dangers of these technologies? You might have seen coded bias recently or the social dilemma. And so there's a lot to talk about and to help organizations understand these technologies to make sure that they can use them in a way that's beneficial for them as well as for society.
So in the book, The Organization of Tomorrow, you talk about themes related to the future of work from a variety of different angles, including just from the perspective of universal basic income and what careers or what job types will be disrupted. I'd love to have you summarize the thesis of the book. What does The Organization of Tomorrow look like?
The book, The Organization of Tomorrow, is basically a management version, an easy to read version of my dissertation of my PhD. My PhDs are generally extremely dry, and so was mine. And I tried to make it a bit easier to read. But I think the main summary is that we are moving to a future where organizations are mostly automated, where data is the key driver to success. And where human and machine collaboration is going to be a key component of the organization of tomorrow. And in my book, I describe obviously the three technologies, which I sort of call the meta trends, big data, blockchain, and AI, because these technologies, these trends, they enable all the other technologies that are out there. And if you look at, for example, at the hype cycle for emerging technologies from Gartner released every year, you can see that all their technologies that are in there sort of relate to these three main meta trends, I would say. And so the organization of tomorrow revolves around data, decentralization, and automation. And I think that the organization of tomorrow will be a lot smaller, a lot leaner, a lot more effective and efficient. We'll see that it will be an organization that is also, depending on how far you integrate these technologies, will be much more flexible to adapt to the environment and how the environment is changing. Because after all, and that's what I always tell the organization as well, is we are living in exponential times. The world around us is changing so fast and faster and faster. And that is partially due to the convergence of these various technologies that are out there, are a kickstarter or a catalyst for each other. We use the Internet of Things to collect vast amounts of data. We use that data to train AI. But with that AI, we can build better computers or even quantum computers. And with quantum computers, we can process data even further, even faster. And then with this latest breakthrough from IBM, where they have this 2-nanometer chip coming out in a couple of years, that's even further is a catalyst for all the things that are happening. So for me, it's obvious that we live in exponential times, and that's also one of the key challenges that I think organizations are facing. Things are going so incredibly fast, and it's you and my job to stay on top of that. And at least for me, it's difficult sometimes to stay on top of it because the developments are going so incredibly fast. So that's what I try to share in the book. Is to know what are some of the key components that as an organization, as a leader, you should be aware of if you want to remain competitive in this fast-changing world.
So there's also a dark side to this proliferation of data. Talk about the implications of more data used in possibly nefarious ways on employees who may not be aware of how their data is being used?
Well, I think this is one of the bigger problems that we are facing in our society. We live in a capitalist world, so data is being used to optimize and make efficient and more effective the organization, often for the benefit of the shareholders. A lot of companies have a short-term approach, very much shareholder-focused approach. So they have a clear driver to use data in new ways and in ways that are sometimes not optimal for the employee or for the customer, but are optimal for the shareholder. And I think that is problematic, especially because data is the most important resource already and even more in the future. And if you start to misuse that data, I think it's seriously problematic for employees and for customers. And there are so many examples out there, and many of them were perfectly shown in the recent movie that was released, Coded Bias, based on the book by Cathy O'Neill, Weapons of Math Destruction, as well as The Social Dilemma, which was released last year. These movies show that there is a problem, and that unfortunately, organizations they are willing to use the technologies in the wrong ways, because as I mentioned, in the end, technology is neutral, and we can use it for positive way to positively contribute to our society or to negatively affect our lives. And unfortunately, I see it too often happening that data is misused by organizations.
Coded Bias is a good reference, so I'll make a point of linking to that in the show notes. Thank you. Now, before we started recording, we were talking about kind of this bifurcation of the business community into, we'll call them the data haves and the data have nots, and specifically the implications of things like Microsoft investing $1 billion in OpenAI. And what does it mean to be a data have not? And how do you catch up with the big five data haves as, we, like you said, live in exponential times?
Well, that is challenging. It's for the incumbents, the traditional organizations that have a legacy IT infrastructure, that have a legacy organization. It's very, very difficult and challenging to turn around. These are massive shifts that require a lot of time to make a shift. While we have these new companies, these purely data driven organizations that are much more flexible. Now, an interesting example, I think, is Alibaba. They on Singles Day, November 11th every year, they do so many transactions per second. And last year, I think they did about 583,000 transactions per second. That's mind blowing. If you compare that to Visa, which is sort of the most well known example, at their peak, they do 56,000 transactions. And the revenue of Alibaba in 24 hours was $73 billion. It's absolutely mind blowing, and the traditional companies they face a lot of difficulties because these tech giants, they have become so big and so powerful that it has become also so easy for them to remove any future competitor, either by purchasing them, because founders like a nice paycheck by the big companies, or by building a competitive product. And I think a very interesting example that we recently have been seen happening is Clubhouse. Clubhouse came out of nowhere, sort of, because of the pandemic. They're valued now. They have now unicorn status, I believe. And now all their downloads are dropping already, I think. Because Twitter launched one, Facebook launched one, LinkedIn launched one. Everyone launched one within the past couple of months. And everyone is having a different, little bit of a different take, but it shows you that these companies, they have such a massive user base that it's for them it's very easy to launch something new and then take over the startup or the one who tries to disrupt, because you simply don't have the power, the purchasing power or the development power that these big tech giants have. And I think that's and then Clubhouse is a startup which is well funded. Imagine the large traditional companies that face a lot more difficulty to change. Look at in the financial services industry, the big banks, they also have to adhere to a lot of regulation, which makes it even more challenging while some new startups might not yet have to deal with that regulation, so they can change and they can adapt a lot faster. So for traditional organizations, it's very challenging to be able to keep up with all the changes that are happening, and to be able to try to integrate these technologies, and then try to keep up with the fast pace of these large tech giants. So it is problematic, and unfortunately, I think we see happening that these tech giants, they are, you know, only growing and becoming more powerful, and it's up to us, the people or the governments, to try to stop them. And there are some more antitrust laws, of course, and processes going on in America, which I think is a good thing. Because if you have a couple of tech giants ruling the world, I don't think that's something we should want.
So clearly society benefits if responsible AI, we'll call it that loosely, prevails. And yet with, to your point, so much data in the hands of so few, there are a very small number of algorithm authors on the planet that control a lot of automated decisions that impact our daily lives. Talk to us about the future of regulatory frameworks. Who should be monitoring for the kinds of decisions that could be potentially based on biased data and have a net negative impact on society, given that it's unlikely that the big five owners of the data are unlikely, as you know, if past is prologue, they're unlikely to regulate themselves.
Yeah, to answer that question, I want to take a little step back first. Last year, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what the effect is going to be of these data technologies, of these new technologies. And I came to the conclusion that we are at the brink of a new global political doctrine that is going to take place and going to take over pretty much all societies in the world. So we're moving away from a society which a lot of societies are organized by liberalism, and I think we are now moving to a society, to societies which are organized by what I call digitalism, digitalism revolves around, you know, the continuous struggle around data and who has access to data, who has control around data, and who can use the data, and I think there are three streams within digitalism that a society can focus on. So the first one is what I call state digitalism, and this is what we see happening in countries such as China, for example, where the state is it really uses these technologies for the benefit of the state, and we have mass surveillance by the state. We have a social credit score where it's very where people are no longer can be anonymous, where privacy doesn't exist, and these technologies are being used to sort of enslave the people within to the benefit of the state. Then the second stream is what I call neo-digitalism, which I think is happening more and more in America, where we have corporate surveillance, where the large tech companies, they have full control over your data, and they have become so powerful that it's become very, very difficult for the governments to rein them in. They have so much lobbying power that they can change the legislation to their favor, which I think to a certain extent we see happening at the moment. For us as consumers, we become sort of enslaved to the companies, and we have, you know, we are in full control by them. It becomes very, very difficult to switch. A clear example, WhatsApp. WhatsApp has this new terms and conditions. I have not yet accepted them, and I probably won't be allowed to use WhatsApp in the next coming days now anymore. I think that's the second stream that we have. And the third stream, which is possible, is what I call modern digitalism. And modern digitalism is where we use these technologies to empower citizens. And so not to enslave, but to really use the technologies for the betterment of the citizens, of the people. And I think that's something that we see happening in Europe. We had the GDPR, which was became into place in 2018. We have the AI regulations that were launched 2 years ago. And we have this new framework that the EU recently launched, where they looked into what kind of AI is high risk and what kind of AI can we use and we should pay attention to or not. And I think these three streams is how it's going to affect how our society will look like and what us as citizens can, how we can benefit from these technologies and if we can benefit from these technologies. And I think to answer your question is what can we do to this? You know, I think as people, we should and try to focus on becoming, you know, part of this modern digitalism where we use these technologies for the betterment. But that can become very, very difficult if your companies in your country has become already so powerful that it's very difficult to resist their lobbying power. But I think we should do our utmost best to resist that, because otherwise we end up in a society where the people are enslaved by the companies, and I don't think that's a good thing.
So more pessimistic view of the regulatory framework than I was expecting.
Well, it's not so pessimistic, because I do think that there are options to come around. But I'm also realistic and knowing that we are living in a capitalist society. If I can use AI to make more money, I'll probably do that as a, you know, from a generic perspective as a company. And I think that's what we see happening. If we want to create a society which is, you know, a great place to live in, we have to find a balance between the optimizing companies to a such an extent that, you know, we don't need any more employees, and a society that is pleasant to live in. How we find that balance, I think we do need some regulation from the government, because otherwise, if we leave it up to the market, they will optimize from a capitalist perspective.
What would you do if, let's say, you know, the EU powers that be asked you how GDPR should be modified to adapt to what's ahead for the next decade? What are your thoughts on the right kind of regulatory framework?
That's a very interesting question, and I think the new framework that they've just launched, where they sort of, you know, put AI into several categories of high risk, lower risk, and minimal risk, where they even said that some AI will not be allowed in Europe. One being social credit scoring, and will not be allowed in Europe because we don't want that in our society. The GDPR has been criticized a lot, you know, with the whole cookie walls, which obviously doesn't work because nobody reads them and everyone clicks them away. And that's sort of also, I think, sort of the problem that governments face all around the world. Technology is going so incredibly fast, and legislation takes so much time to get into place. So it's very difficult to make legislation that is right for the technology that's in the market at that moment. And the only way to get around that is to, one, have a lot of people in parliament or in the government who understand these technologies, which unfortunately is not the case. You know, if only in the example in America, where one of the members asked Mark Zuckerberg, how does Facebook make money? You know, quite well known, you know, that sort of shows it. But I think this happens in every country, also in my country, the Netherlands, where, you know, there's a clear lack of understanding of what these technologies mean and how these technologies will impact our lives. So I think it's, we need to create a way that we can adapt the legislation based on the technologies that are out there. So we need to create some kind of a framework that's easy to adapt to fit the technologies that are out there. And what this framework would, you know, entail is, I find it difficult to give a recommendation. But I think what the EU has now done with making four categories is a great starting point already.
You make the argument that one of the outcomes of this kind of decade plus resurgence of populism is the rise of blockchain and blockchain related technologies, decentralized authentication or verification of transactions. Talk to us about where you see blockchain helping this problem of kind of the democratization of decision-making, the more even distribution or access to data. I've got fresh in my mind, you know, last week, the Colonial pipeline got hacked, and as ransom, they took Bitcoin. And so, you know, if I were to take the bearish side of use of blockchain, it was just used essentially to hijack the financial system. You're an expert on blockchain. Where do you see blockchain technologies being used for good, as well as maybe to do harm, you know, over the next period ahead?
Yeah, so I think there are two things at play here. First of all, blockchain to me is a fundamental technology that will revolutionize how we organize our society. I'll get to that in a second. And then the second one is the Colonial Pipeline Bitcoin ransom, which is, I think, it is a warning to what is to come. Most organizations, unfortunately, are vastly underprepared for the attacks that are coming our way. I believe there's research saying that by 2025, you know, cybercrime will cause $5 to $10 trillion of damages to the world economy. As organizations, we are not prepared, and we will never be prepared, because by definition, hackers are more advanced than organizations, because for hackers, it's their core job attacking companies using IT, and for, you know, a retailer, it's not their core job to protect their IT. So that's, you know, we always have this fight, and we'll move towards a system where probably AI will fight AI to attack companies and to protect companies. But that's the other part. If we look at blockchain, you know, I think, you know, of course, blockchains can be used for good, and blockchains can be used for bad. You know, my second book, Blockchain and Transforming Our Business and Our World, was about how we can use blockchain for social good. You know, we can use blockchain to solve the identity crisis. We can use blockchain to fight climate change, to fight misinformation, to enable fair trade, to create more democratic elections, etc. But we can also use it, the applications of these, for, you know, the more negative sides, such as the ransomware. And as I mentioned earlier, for me, blockchain is, you know, a fundamental technology that has the opportunity to truly change our society. It offers transparency of what is going on. It offers provenance of data, but also of products and how they have moved through supply chains. Because we use smart contracts, which are immutable, verifiable, and traceable, you know, we created a new way of trust in the system that wasn't there before. Or at least where we had to use a third-party intermediary, which, as we have shown probably in history, not always were trustworthy either. The fact that blockchain enables these peer-to-peer collaboration, where we rely on math and on cryptography, I think is a great way forward. And it offers us an opportunity to not only make our society more effective and efficient, but also more trustworthy and more transparent. So yeah, I'm a big fan of blockchain. I think that we're definitely not there yet in terms of development. We are really, I think, I would say actually really early stage. I would almost say we are. You could compare where the development of blockchain to where the internet was in maybe 1997 or 1998, very early stage. If we see that we can do on the Bitcoin blockchain or the Ethereum blockchain, you can do 7 to 10, 15 transactions per second. And I just talked about Alibaba doing 583,000 transactions per second. There's still a long way to go. I know, of course, there are more new types of blockchains coming, which are better capable of doing thousands or even hundreds of thousands of transactions per second. So we are getting there, but there's still a lot of development required. And the community is working incredibly hard to make that happen. But there's still quite some time to go, I think, before we can, you know, really decentralize and democratize our society.
So you got a lot of listeners out there who are kind of doing some career planning. And thinking about the fact that the pace of technology is, call it, it's exponential. And they're trying to figure out, you know, what it means to be a leader in a society that, you know, is trying to acclimate, you know, against this technological backdrop. What's your advice to them about some of the skills that they could be investing in that will kind of transcend or support, or, you know, embrace these new technologies? What are the kinds of things that just are not likely to be automated by machines anytime in the near future?
I would say learn to program, something that I wish I was capable of. But then again, you know, even we have also AI now that can create AI. So even coding can be automated. Now, but joking aside, you know, I think for people who want to start doing some career planning, I think it's more about what kind of attitude you have. You know, you have to be flexible, you have to be adaptive, you have to be open to change, you have to be good at analyzing problems and taking actions accordingly. So your analytical skills are going to be very, very important. And I think it's not so much to necessary to master one skill and use that for the rest of your life, because we don't have lifelong careers anymore. You know, what we you should be open to basically disrupt your own career every 10 years, every maybe 5 years, and you should be able to and willing to reinvent yourself on a continuous basis. And that's tiring, you know, that's difficult. I notice as an entrepreneur, you know, I constantly have to reinvent myself based on the market changes. And I enjoy doing it, but it's hard work. In general, people don't like change. Well, you're going to have a hard time in this world if you don't like change, because you will face so much change in the coming decades. It's incredible. And I was recently reading a book, The Future is Faster Than You Think, from Peter Diamandis, among others. I really enjoyed reading the book and the way they describe what kind of future possibilities they see. And even I was amazed by what the kind of ideas they present in the book of how our world will look like in 5 to 10 years from now. It's incredible. And we have to be able to deal with that. That's going to be challenging, and we have to start preparing ourselves for that.
Now, we're about out of time, but before I can let you go, I want to make sure that you have a chance to tell our listeners where they can learn more about your work.
Sure. So I'm quite a bit on the internet, so you can find more information about my digital avatar or my avatar. So my digital twin, where you can find it on thedigitalspeaker.com. You can find information on me on my personal website, which is vanrijmenam.nl, which is a bit more difficult, but I guess you can find it in the link underneath there. And that's where you can find information. Otherwise, a Google search or you go to datafog.com or maven.org to find more information about what I'm doing.
Excellent. We'll also link to all these resources that you've mentioned in the show notes. Dr. Mark, this felt like about 7 or 8 conversations that we packed into one short episode. Maybe if we can invite you back and we'll unpack some of these topics in more detail. How does that sound?
That sounds like an excellent idea. I think there's so much to say. We can easily talk for hours and hours on this. It's great to have these kind of conversations where we unpack, you know, how technology is changing our world and how fast the world is changing.
Well, such an enjoyable conversation, and certainly a starting point for future ones. Well, that's all the time that we have for this week. I encourage you, again, follow Dr. Mark on Twitter. Go pick up a copy of one or more of his books, watch his digital twin on YouTube, and let us know in the show notes what you thought about it. This is Dan Turchin signing off for this week, host of AI in the Future of Work, but fear not, back next week with another fascinating guest.